Welcome to Uproar in the Studio, your bi-weekly New York-based Chinese blockbuster podcast. It is the end of season one of this podcast. I'm Noah.
I'm Reza.
I'm Andrew.
For our final episode of season one, we are talking about Wolf Warrior 2, released on July 28th, 2017. It made almost $900 million. You don't have to see the movie, we'll give a synopsis, but if you want to watch it unspoiled, and this one might actually be worth watching unspoiled, maybe listen to the show after.
Later, we'll have two interviews that probably constitute the most comprehensive source in English on the making of Wolf Warrior 2. First, we'll be talking about the score with the film's composer, Joseph Trapanese, whose work has previously appeared in Tron Legacy, Oblivion, and The Greatest Showman. His latest score can be heard in this summer's Stuber.
After, we'll have action director Sam Hargrave, whose stunt coordinating can also be seen in the Avengers films and Atomic Blonde. His directorial debut is the forthcoming DACA.
But before that, we are talking about the movie with friend of the show, Carl Zha, host of the podcast Silk and Steel. Follow him on Twitter at Carl Zha to check out his travels through China. Here is our conversation.
When Lang Feng, an elite soldier of the PLA, is disgraced and imprisoned for the unintentional murder of a haughty real estate magnate, he exiles himself to Africa, where he works as a mercenary security contractor for aid missions. The nation Feng is stationed in suddenly becomes overrun with rebels and more hired guns, led by an American codenamed Big Daddy. Chinese citizens are quickly evacuated, but when Feng learns that his fiancée was murdered long ago by the team of mercs now causing havoc for him again, he takes it upon himself to track down Big Daddy and deliver justice for China. While he fights his way through armies, Feng also serves as protector of Dr. Chen, his colleague Dr. Rachel Smith, and his adopted daughter Pasha. Dr. Chen is working on finding a cure for the deadly disease Lamanla, and after Chen is killed by mercenaries, Feng learns that Pasha carries within her the experimental cure for the disease. In a final showdown, Big Daddy tells Feng that the bullet that killed his fiancée came from his gun, and in a rage, Feng finally kills the rebel leader. Bouncing missiles, flipping tanks, and an oddly placed Amazing Grace. This is Wolf Warrior 2.
When did you first... You said you watched it in the theaters, right?
Yeah, I actually saw it in the United States because I saw the advertisement for Wolf Warrior 2 like about a year before it came out. I saw it on Weibo, on Chinese social media. And at the time, it was a very short clip. I thought it looked ridiculous. And I when I realized that movie was going to be released in US simultaneously, I was curious, but I went to the theater expecting it to be really cringy. And so I had the expectation I'm going to be there, watch it in my Mystery Science 3000.
Yeah. but it totally turned out to be awesome, right?
I know. I was like, as soon as the movie start, like the opening shot, that was just amazing. I was just blown away by that, and like it was just nonstop action. Like there was like so many. There's like different scenes, and they just kind of roll from one to another. And I was pleasantly surprised. Let me tell you.
It's like one of the only ones they, you know, put the time in for the music too, and it really keeps up with it. I don't know. We were talking about this recently too.
Yeah, I did some research afterwards. It looks like they got some help from Hollywood.
We talked to the help for later in this episode.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah. I mean that shows. I mean, like. You know, I expected to see like a dodgy Chinese production where they have like just like really cringy unconvincing, like patriotic education type of propaganda movie. But what I got was Chinese Rambo, which is great.
Wu Jing's just too cool for that second rate stuff.
Yeah, how did you guys hear about it?
It's the number one. Andrew and I just like watched it a few years ago, like during a summer. This is way before we thought about doing the show, just because it made so much money, I guess, both of us.
We were like, oh, wow, I'd never heard of this movie, and this movie's huge. Maybe I should see it.
Gotta be interesting in some way.
Exactly. And it turned out to be...
Yeah, so the funny thing is so I was pretty hyped about the movie after I seen it. I went on social media, you know, like, totally hyping it. So some of my Facebook friends, they went out and got Wolf Warrior 1, you know, on video. Mm. And they're like, dude, that Wolf Warrior 1 sucked. I'm like, dude, I didn't even see Wolf Warrior 1. But, you know, just go watch Wolf Warrior 2. You know, it's like supposedly a sequel, but it's really a standalone movie, and it kicked ass.
It totally does. I think I might be the only one of us who watched Wolf Warrior 1 as well. And it's a lot less of a exciting, like the locations aren't as exotic. It's more of like a training exercise for most of it, which kind of makes sense that, you know, a training exercise for this next movie.
I think it was supposed to be like a low budget movie, like, but the Wolf Warrior 2 was a major upgrade. Like the producer and producer director and the actor Wu Jing, he actually supposedly put his house in Beijing as collateral. But he made out. I mean, like, he was probably the greatest investor that year.
He does that consistently, because he did that on Wandering Earth, too. He, like, put up a bunch of the money for Wandering Earth.
He did that right after Wolf Warrior 2.
Crazy.
He's a pro.
Yeah. Did he get a producer credit for that, or was it just investment?
For Wandering Earth, I think he might have gotten a producer credit. I'm not sure.
I don't know, but he was a major investor. Like, I think what happened was Wandering Earth had some ran into some financial difficulties. So the director went to look for, you know, went to talk to him, basically trying to get money, because after the huge success of Wolf Warrior 2, and they start talking, and they agreed to bring him on for a small role, and that small role turned out to be big. I think his role was supposed to be like a minor character in the book, and then they just kind of blow it up, and
in the best way possible.
They did his entire part like after making the rest of the movie,
like 7 months after. Yeah, it's crazy. Carl, do you know anything about like Wu Jing before these movies? Because I've only seen him in like the SBL Killzone movies, apart from like his more recent stuff. Do you know?
Yeah, that's what he's famous for. I mean, that's his like breakout movie. I mean, his background is like in martial arts. He's like Jet Li, right? Like he was a national champion, and then he went into the movie business. And supposedly in the SPL Killzone, so he paired with Donnie Yen, right?
Yep.
Most people know from Star Wars
or Ip Man, right?
Yeah, and Ip Man, and so back then, you know, there were actually some gossip about the SPL Killzone, because Donnie Yen kind of dissed Wu Jing, because Wu Jing was this like nobody coming out of mainland, and Donnie Yen was already a big star in Hong Kong, so you know there was some personality conflict there. Mm-hmm. I think and at least Wu Jing felt slighted.
they give him awful hair in the first SBL too. He's got this like weird blonde.
Yeah, I actually never seen that movie entirely. I just saw the clips, the, like, you know, the best fighting clips. Like him with
the knife fight between them. Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, I gotta watch that one.
Amazing.
But he's also...
Wu Jing ever come up in China? Like, is he like a... Do kids like him the way, I don't know, kids like Iron Man in America or something? Because I feel like I do, at least.
I mean, like, really, I mean, you know, he had the breakout role in the Killzone, but really, he got big for Wolf Warrior. Like he made a kind of small name, niche name for himself when he made Wolf Warrior 1. You know, it's a low budget movie, but he actually made decent returns. But the Wolf Warrior 2 is really that, you know, made him a household name.
Yeah, I didn't realize, I'm just on the Wikipedia page looking at this movie. I didn't realize that he wasn't just the star of this movie. He's
the director.
Dude, he did everything.
He had a co-writing credit.
He sings the song.
He sings. Oh, wow.
He's just like Clint Eastwood.
Also,
yeah.
This movie was China's submission for Best Foreign Language Film at the 90th Academy Awards.
As it should have been. It's so good.
But, like, so was Operation Red Sea, you know? And I feel like that has little to do with Wu Jing.
Razor, we did not like Operation Red Sea.
I mean, man, that movie, it's just, I never expected something from Chinese cinema like that. I mean, the whole movie, I just rewatched it before talking to you guys. The opening shot was amazing. It opens up this, like, ocean view off the coast of Africa. I mean, like, it immediately drowns you in the exotic locale. And then the water, underwater fighting scene, man,
that's
you didn't waste time. You went right for the action. And that's what, you know, that's like, okay, this is what I came here for.
In the bloopers, you can see a little bit of how they film that underwater fight scene. Like, they swim up to him with, like, an oxygen mask. I don't know. I thought that was pretty cool that they, like...
I didn't see that. When I was first watching that movie in theater, I was like, dude, I mean, really? Like, are you fighting underwater? Like, how much impact does it really hurt if you kick somebody in the water? that's what was going through my mind. But, you know, I still enjoy it nevertheless. And then what surprised me was the next scene, which was a little bit emotional, and he went to return his comrade's ash, I guess his comrade from Wolf Warrior 1, which I haven't seen. Yep. And then, like, what surprised me about that scene was it's a scene about the thugs, local developers hiring the thugs to demolish the home of his comrade. And this is actually a kind of, like, this is really controversial issue in China, because in China there's a lot of conflicts between people who are forced to move, and there's so-called, like, nailed houses, who, you know, like the people who just refuse to move, and then in many cases the developers, sometimes in cahoots with the local government, they'll hire these thugs to go in and smash up the house and just demolish people's houses. So I was shocked to see that actually on big screen in a Chinese cinema. Like, I did not expect that. I did not expect that at all. And especially, he also was playing as a People's Liberation Army's, I guess, special force officer. And you know, like, in an old style Chinese propaganda movie, you would expect, It turns out, he refrained from his anger and follows the rule of law.
Not in this one.
No.
He's a wolf warrior. Once a wolf warrior, always a wolf warrior.
Well, in the first one, the way that we're sort of introduced to him is he and his team are in this, like, shootout, and basically he shoots the same spot in a wall. So basically there's been a ceasefire ordered, but he keeps shooting at this, like, guy holding a hostage through a wall. From the very start, he's like, I'm not the one who's going to follow orders, you know? He's the wolf warrior from the start.
Yeah, that kind of make it stand out from the old style, you know, the Chinese state and media films. Because, immediately in this scene, he confronts the rogue developer, and you can see the point where, you know, that when the developer threatened his comrade's family, you can see he made a calculated move that he was going to kill the guy, you know. He was just going to take care of the problem right there, even though he knew the consequences. Like, he will probably go to a jail time, but he didn't care. He's just gonna take care of the problem. And like, immediately that marked him as the maverick, right? I mean, like, that kind of set the whole scene. And it, like, this whole movie is very American in a way.
Totally.
Like, I think Rambo is, like, a Chinese Rambo is a total apt description. Because it's, there's a lot of glorification of individualism right there.
Yeah, they really
the entire way through. It's just him. Like, we watched Operation Red Sea, and I think it ends up being like very similar sort of location, like setting, but it's just one guy. He frees the entire like workforce. It's like a very similar setting, but like just zoomed in.
Like the one man army, right? He's like the Chinese Rambo.
And like, apparently Xi Jinping like loved the first one and then was really waiting on the second one. So like, that's kind of like just weird. Like, it's well, pretty inaccurate everything we hear about the PLA.
There will be a third one coming up soon, so he'll have that to look forward to.
That's what happened. They show at the end of the movie, right? Wolf Warrior.
Yeah.
Set up for this like really exciting kind of suspense trailer for Wolf Warrior 3, but I don't know. Like, it's because I heard rumors that Wolf Warrior 3 might be canned.
He was going to freak
out. It might just be a rumor. It was like those Chinese social media rumors, because there was a rumor going around that there's a temporary what's it called?
Moratorium.
Moratorium for movies like Wolf Warrior 2 and Operation Red Sea, because, you know, some people complain that, you know, it showed too much of China flexing its muscle, and they don't want to project that kind of image in the era of trade war with U.S.
Too soon.
To scare up unnecessary patriotism, you know, like when people are already getting riled up, they don't want to, like... they don't want to rock the boat too much. That's what I heard.
I've seen that too. I've seen a couple of articles about that.
Speaking of that last scene, though, at the end of it, that was sort of the Wolf Warrior 3 trailer, I think this is the only movie we've watched on this podcast that had a stinger scene.
Dude, it's basically a Marvel movie. They're just going for, like, the Hollywood
Well, they hired movie. The Marvel, like, parts of the Marvel stunt team, too.
Oh, really?
Interesting. Yeah, and I read somewhere that Joe and Anthony Russo were brought on as advisors in part for this, the directors of the latest Avengers. Do we want to talk about the African setting of this? Because
absolutely.
China's been like a major player in Africa for a long time now, like maybe becoming the major player in a way.
Like, this movie came up a bunch.
This is probably the first Chinese movie that, you know, big Chinese movie that took place in Africa. I mean, like, I'm discounting all those Jackie Chan movies.
Sure.
But, like, I'm talking about, like, a mainland Chinese production that has Africa as a backdrop. I mean, in a way, like, it kind of plays to the... You know, the Chinese current Belt and Road Initiative, the new Silk Road project, where you know, the Chinese firms are urged to go out to places like Africa, invest in, you know, infrastructure and get involved in different projects. You can kind of see that in the movie. You see all these different Chinese people in kind of various different capacities, and then you see like the Chinese Navy getting involved. Actually, the part of the operation, part of the plot of the movie is sort of based on the Chinese evacuation of Chinese nationals during the Libyan war. During the overthrow of Gaddafi, there were like tens of thousands of Chinese workers who were in Libya, and so the Chinese Navy sent out couple of ships to evacuate the Chinese national. And same with the Operation Red Sea, which you guys talk about. That was based on the
Yemen.
The Yemen evacuation during the Yemen Civil War, when Chinese Navy sent another warship to evacuate the Chinese national. Of course, they made it like totally Hollywood. And added all these like fighting and explosions. But really amazed me about the Wolf Warrior 2. One is this, it's really taking a big chance. It's sitting in the exotic locale of Africa. It's about the total promotion of individualism.
Yeah,
it's like basically a Hollywood movie in played by a Chinese guy.
Well, so what's interesting also about Wu Jing as a Chinese guy, because there was some controversy after this movie about him having a Hong Kong passport, despite the Chinese passport at the end of it. His son has, I think, some sort of EU citizenship. His son has a green card. His wife also has some, like, you know.
Yeah, because one of the big draw of the movie, right, like, you place really on the Chinese nationalism.
Yeah.
It's very explicit by the last scene with a passport that says, I think, like,
wherever you are, we'll protect
possessor
you.
Possessor of this passport, we will protect you. And also that's reflected in the movie posters, because one of the movie poster it paraphrased a really famous ancient saying. The original saying is from like 200 BC Han Dynasty general who led a very far off expedition into Central Asia to fight off the Xiongnu or the Hans, and he to justify his action, he famously said something like "Fan wo chang hanzi, sui yuan bi zu," which means whoever offends the strong Han, no matter how far, we will get you. And the
oh god,
and and the movie poster. So the movie poster for Wolf Warrior 2, they paraphrase that, except instead of using Han, they use China. So like whoever offends China, no matter how far, we will get you. Nationalism is a big part of the appeal of the movie to the Chinese moviegoers. I was in the United States, right? I was watching this in Orange County. The theater was full, and it's all like overseas Chinese or diaspora. And at the end of the movie, they had like standing ovations, people standing up and clapping when the passport appeared on the screen. I was like, wow, like that was pretty amazing. The strong association with Chinese nationalism this movie has. There are a lot of people like Wu Jing's critics in China, trying to dig up dirt on him. Why do you have a Hong Kong passport there? Why does your son have foreign green card or passport? Because Wu Jing was being criticized for, cashing in on nationalism for his movie. And I think he responded saying, like, what's wrong with that? I'm Chinese. And I think it's because of that remark people are doing some background check on him. And so.
It's also interesting that it's not just a show of, like, China protecting its people. It's in the factory where he's, like, everybody's leaving.
Responsibility to protect, the only ones there to do it.
I still feel like that's a very American, though. you kind of expect that in a Hollywood movie as well. And there are parts where, the setting is in Africa, the locale, but in a way, a lot of the African people and the locale serve more like a prop, like Hollywood movies.
Yeah.
If you think about it, all the African characters in the movie, the little kid he kind of adopts, and the kid's mom, they're kind of like just the comedy relief.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't have like a really strong African character who is, you know, I mean, like, there's more character in the villains, right? I actually like how they have individual personality for the villains, like the Great Bear.
Big Daddy.
Big Daddy. Daddy, yeah.
Yeah, the Athena, the ghost, you know, like, you have these individual villains where they're all different personalities. I think it was also, like, a very intentional of the movie to have the villains as some European mercenary.
Well, and, American mercenaries, well,
American
too.
Specifically, yeah.
Oh, they were American? Okay, I wasn't sure. Like,
well, so, like...
No, they didn't specifically say American mercenary, but there were...
Obviously, Frank Grillo is American.
Oh, right, right. I mean, everybody was speaking, I mean, except for Big Bear, right?
Yeah,
obviously Russian. the head honcho, Big Daddy, he's, you know, Frank...
Frank Grillo.
Yeah, he's speaking with American. I just assumed they're supposed to be, like, European mercenaries in Africa just because, you know, Europe... I mean, in my mind, somehow, Europe were more involved in Africa. And that was a very conscious decision to cast, them as the villains because, you know, Europeans, that's associated with traditional associated with colonialism in Africa. But whereas, like, the Africans are the people that needs to be saved, you know, in a way, that's not too different from Hollywood. Like, you know, like in Hollywood, you have the American hero go to some exotic locale like Africa to go save the locals. But yeah,
this
all
is like a weird white man's burden kind of movie, but just Chinese.
Yes, yes. That's why I think like a Chinese Rambo is a total apt description for Wu Jing. And I wish they could have done a little bit more, but I guess it's kind of expected because even though China is having more engagement with Africa right now, but for vast majority of Chinese people, you know, Africa is just as remote as it is for most Americans. I mean, it kind of serves as a movie prop, basically.
Although there are, like, a large number of Chinese, like, civilians going over there for, like, you know, to start businesses, to start work. From what I've read, it's, like, in some ways... people use it as sort of like the American West in the 1800s, in that, like, there are already people there, but we're going to go set up, and there are, like, obviously way fewer people there. There's more opportunity there. What I've read people talk about.
I mean, there's, like, enough Chinese in, like, Ethiopia to basically qualify as a minor demographic.
Yeah. There are, like,
100,000 at least or something.
In Namibia, there are border towns that are controlled, like, that are, like, almost entirely Chinese, which is amazing to me. It's
and this very recent development.
Yeah,
too,
West,
happened,
couple,
like,
decades.
Since 2000. I mean, like, it's literally just last 10, 20 years. You know, I mean, like Africa before is just so exotic, you know? Like, but now it's, you know, you have people who are in Africa, have local connections and bring in their, like, relatives from China going over there. And, like, it's funny because I was just talking to my cousin and he told me about one of his friend who is in Africa.
Oh, wow.
Do some kind of import-export of seafood because there's, like, abundance of seafood in Africa, sure. I forgot which country they were in. But one of the problems, because of the distance, right, the only way they can do it is by airlift. And so what they do is they try to do these airlift all these crabs, from live crabs from Africa to China. Like, it was very detailed. Like, so the 90% of the crabs would actually survive to make it to Guangzhou. But if any city who is any further away from Guangzhou, like Shanghai or Beijing, the survival rate just not good enough to make a profit. But I was just amazed. Like, here's my cousin, you know, talking about his business in Africa. Yeah, it's more a lot more common now, apparently.
Pretty amazing.
What's your take on how positive, like, the relationship comes off in the movie?
This is a Chinese movie, man. I mean,
yeah.
It's
like, but it's like super, super positive, right? Like, he adopts a kid, you know?
He does.
First of all, like, that's what kind of a Chinese audience are expecting. And this is also, like, this kind of go along with official Chinese narrative about, you know, the Chinese role in Africa is to win-win, right? To help the Africans. And, yeah, that's why I wish, like, they had a little bit more actual African involvement in the movie. It's like very, it's just like the Chinese version of Hollywood, where Africans are kind of the passive subject, you know. They're being acted upon. They're
recipients of aid.
Well, actually, literally, the sort of MacGuffin is the little girl, the little African girl that, like, everybody's trying to sort of chase down for the
antidote or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But after all that criticism, I have to say, at least, you know, like, you try to promote, right, some sort of Chinese-African friendship, and that it's, yeah, I think it's well-intentioned. You may not reflect the reality on the ground, but the movie itself is well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, this is Belt and Road in theory.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It's Belt and Road in cinema. There you go. and think about trying to get back to the movie.
It's battle we haven't talked about. Like, there's so many amazing set pieces we haven't talked about. Like, a tank battle. Like, yes, oh my god.
But even before that, there was the scene where the scene where they went. Yeah, they're like, I was thinking about just all the, even like some funny moments, like when he rescued the American doctor Rachel, mm-hmm. and they were driving back through the savannah, and she said, "Oh yeah, we should go to the American embassy." Yeah, because there will be Marines there to protect us, and there was like a total opportunity for the movie to kind of snub the Americans, because then Wu Jin asked, kick her, "Oh wait, how did you contact them?" And she's like, "Oh, I added their Twitter." That was the funniest moment I remember. And right after that, you know, because Wu Jin laughed at her and just basically tells her, "Oh yeah, I saw the American flags on those ships leaving the harbor," and so she got pissed and she stepped out of the jeep, and then like right away, the camera pans out to like these lions on the side of the road, just like munching on the zebra, and she's like, "Oh crap!" And then she's very carefully backs into the jeep again. I mean, that was a great scene. I loved it. Or even before that, when their jeep like kind of turned over in the pit of dead bodies. It was like one moment it was like this a classic car chase movie, and then this next moment you have like zombie apocalypse, you know, when all these patients suffers of the so-called lambda virus were like gathering around them. I was like, "Whoa, what happened?" Like, it's almost like it's turning into a zombie movie, right? Like, right there, there was a moment of tension there, and then
he gets confused too, because he goes to like shoot them, and she's like, "No, no longer an action movie."
Yeah.
After that intense car chase scene, they just have like a bunch of food aid in the jeeps,
right? Somehow.
For some reason, all this food. That was just great pacing. I mean, like, it kind of
it
pretty seamlessly from one scene to another. And before we even get to the tank battle, what about those drones, man? Like, I think that's the first time I seen in like a big blockbuster where like the drones were.
Oh hell yeah.
Like the arm.
That was one of the first things before, like, we ever, you know, thought about doing this as a show. It was like that really got to me, like the urban warfare, like just seamlessly used the drone.
I mean, I just love how you rose from one action to another, because hey, I'm an action fan, and you know, I'm a great me and my friends both agreed the Mad Max Fury Road was the greatest movie, because there's
so
dialogue and all action.
So good.
and I I feel that's what we got out of this movie, because it basically goes from action scene to action scene, but it does it well. It like kind of it adds a little bit of humor, you know, and the actors, they have good chemistries. So it was great. I loved it.
There was, I mean, for that drone scene specifically, it was like a little bit of Army of Two almost, right? With that older PLA soldier.
Oh, yeah.
They just take down a drone by themselves, like jumping off a truck or something.
Oh, my God. That was so good. He's like jumping with a burning thing to like hit the drone off the bus there. Ah, amazing. Literally fighting a drone.
Yeah. And I love this like little characterization, because when they first rode in the factory, the young factory owner, I mean, he was like a freaking show-off punk, right? And like,
yeah.
and then you know then you pretty soon realize that doorman, that old the factory guard, the OPLA guy, was really the guy that know what he's talking about, and the young guy kind of got put in his place a little bit, but he redeemed himself later.
He does.
When he shoots I think the turning point is when he shoots the like big bear guy through the neck, and he's like, "Didn't your mother ever tell you not to fuck with spoiled brats?"
Yeah.
I was a little confused by that, like what they were going for with that.
I think it's just it was a little self-deprecating humor, right, about himself, because like he's used a term in Chinese, "熊孩子," literally. In Chinese, it literally means like bear child, but it means spoiled brat, and then I don't know. I think it just works well. That scene worked well for me.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
And I really like I really like they have, like I said earlier, they have these different characterization even for the villains. They have like the big bear, the Russian guy, and his partner Athena, really really badass girl, and then they have that Asian guy Ghost, you know, like each one all have like something different, and you know they're not like they're supposed to be bad guys, but they're cool.
Well, that's
the best bad guys are.
That's a big step up from the first movie, where like the main mercenary, he's like sort of a big daddy type, and he's called a former like US SEAL, but he's got a British accent, and he's the only one with personality. The rest of them are just like sort of flat caricatures. Literally a car blows up in front of them, and one of them goes with a monotone intonation, "Interesting."
Yeah. Yeah, that's why people like told me, "Well, Wolf Warrior 1 sucked ass." I mean,
it's Wu Jing still pretty fucking cool in Wolf Warrior 1. You still get plenty of good Wu Jing.
Yeah. He's good. He's good. I mean, like the whole Wolf Warrior, trilogy is really his baby. I mean, he planted out, you know, Wolf Warrior 1 and then Wolf Warrior 2. Like, I think he planned it out in such a way, like, he started small with Wolf Warrior 1, so he would have a little bit more budget to work with Wolf Warrior 2. I really hope the rumor about canning of Wolf Warrior 3 is not true, because I would like totally. Yeah,
I mean, at this point, it would be an instant, like it would rock it up to number one. I think
it would. Yeah, it would just destroy the top 10 list. It would just and also what's interesting about this movie is that almost it seems like a huge chunk of it takes place in English. Even with like some of the dialogue Wu Jing delivers is in English. So I don't, and it didn't make much money abroad, but it seems almost like that decision might have had something to do with trying to export it as a movie.
You're right. I just realized that. When you bring it up, you're right. Yeah, but that's funny how that worked out, because really the movie appealed to, you know, Chinese audiences.
Yeah.
You know, reason of appeal to the nationalism. I mean, it became like one of the world's largest top grossing movie, just purely on the strength of
Chinese market.
And also, like, I think one dot, the owner of AMC, they made a very good calculated decision to release Wolf Warrior 2 only in like cities and areas with large Chinese population.
Yeah.
So that's why I got to see it in LA, in parts of Orange County where there's enough Chinese moviegoers, they will release it. And I actually went to see it twice.
Nice. Nice.
Wow. So the first time I was, I didn't expect anything. I was going in the mood of Mystery Science 3000, and I got blown away. And so I went to see it a second time. Both time, the movie was, it was packed. It was mostly Chinese, part Chinese or Chinese nationals or overseas Chinese. And I think that's what it was going for. But you're right. There was like that kind of international, it's trying to add that international flavor. Mm-hmm. Also the cast too, right? The American doctor, Rachel, she was an American actress. Well, her mom was born in Hong Kong. She grew up in Hong Kong, so she's like half-half. But like the, Frank... he's obviously American Hollywood actor.
Don't hire a good villain.
They went out of their way to get someone who's actually a very good actor to play that character. A lot of personality. But I think we can't end this conversation without talking about the final climax with so many tank fights. And it's not just in Operation Red Sea, there's tanks firing on each other, but here it's a lot more creative. They flip a tank, but just by running,
outruns a tank.
Exactly.
there was tank drifting, right? Easily the top, one of the top action scene in recent memory. I did not expect that. And it was very well choreographed too.
Totally
believable.
Flipping a tank could have been super goofy, but honestly, I was there for it.
They did it right. Yeah. I think it is all about pacing. Like with tanks, I think if they ever appear in a movie, you kind of think of it like a World War II thing. They're sort of lumbering, they're a little bit slow, and it's kind of uninteresting. And I kind of felt that way in Red Sea. But here, it's the pacing of it. It's, you have that tight focus on Wu Jing the whole time. It's man versus tank in a big way, I think that's what makes it work.
Do you guys know who, helped did the edit of the movie? Because, they did an amazing job.
Yeah, I know the audio editing was partly done in New Zealand, but the actual editing, I think, was, fully Chinese, is my understanding.
Oh, wow.
Fully Wu Jing's team. Wu Jing's just got that timing.
Yeah. He must not sleep.
Apparently he's a real hard worker.
Yeah, I think, because, Hollywood movies are silly popular in China, right? The Chinese audience enjoy the Hollywood-style action, but they enjoy it more when they see, a Chinese face, right? But with, the Hollywood style, I think that's what made it such a big draw for the Chinese audience. It's something they never seen before. It's very fresh. In a way, that's what they've been waiting for all along.
Well, also, as need to say that as Big Daddy crawls out of the tank, my favorite line in the movie, just one of my favorite line in any Chinese movie I've ever seen, which is, I guess the Chinese military ain't as lame as I thought. It's amazing.
That's what the whole movie was there for. The entire budget was for that one line.
Yeah, it's the punchline.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, one of the thing about Wolf Warrior 2 is, people were surprised. It got green-lighted by the Chinese censorship board, because normally, the Chinese censorship people, they're very anal, right? But there was so much, violence and action. Yeah. I think one of the reason it got green-lighted, because Wolf Warrior 2 have kind of the implicit backing of the PLA, and ultimately, PLA is the one that telling the the Chinese censor what to do, and not vice versa. So there was even like a social media joke about that. Like they show pictures of like the Chinese censor wielding the big scissors, you know, like having the power trip over all the domestic movie production, and then the PLA comes from behind with the big guns, like, okay, you're gonna pass these movies. Wolf Warrior 2 and Operation Red Sea.
Well, apparently the like editing stage of the movie was super, super stressful because the censors were really pushing to make changes in it. And that, you know, I'm just so curious to see what like the version of this movie was before they got to it.
The intense editing.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope they come out with like a director cut or something.
Yeah, that'd be so cool.
Wu Jing's personal like Wolf Warrior 2.
Yeah. Well, also, speaking of the PLA being involved in these movies, do you know anything, Carl, about, because like it seems like I don't think they're getting their own tanks. I wonder if they, you know, borrow the equipment of the PLA to make these movies.
Oh, right. But I did not pay attention in Wolf Warrior 2, but for Operation Red Sea, those were non-Chinese weapons. Like they actually made a kind of plausible excuse in the movie, say, oh, because we're operating kind of under UN jurisdiction or whatever. That's why we use the non-Chinese weapons or something like that. I think the most obviously thing that was Chinese in both movies are the, you know, the Chinese warships, right? They're kind of splicing the real footage of the Chinese Navy in both movies, and in the ocean. Part of it's CGI, and the other part is like the real PLA Navy footage, exercise footage.
Yeah.
I was looking up the tanks when we were watching Wolf Warrior 2, like the last time we did last week, and I'm pretty sure they were like Type 59, which is modeled on the Soviet T-54, the World War II tank.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. So I had that association for a good reason.
I mean, yeah, that's so dope.
Makes sense. Yeah.
Nice.
There's a whole Wikipedia on the weapons. Like, every single weapon used in the movie, somebody compiled a Wikipedia of.
People love this movie. We love this movie.
We love this movie, dude.
I love this movie, yeah. We're in complete agreement here.
Thanks to Carl Zsa, here's our conversation with Wolf Warrior 2 composer Joseph Trapanese.
How did you initially hear about the Wolf Warrior 2 project?
Well, actually, let me tell you the full story. What it was is I got a call from my agent, and he said, hey, there's a Chinese director in town who's trying to understand better how to create a score, create a soundtrack for his movie. He did a movie called Wolf Warrior. It was a huge hit. They're gearing up for the sequel, and he wants to meet with a music supervisor and a composer. Will you come in and meet with him and meet with him as a composer? And I was under the assumption, and so was my agent, that this was purely a fact-finding tour of, you know, the director was trying to understand what he was trying to do. But, you know, we had a super positive meeting just talking about how, you know, music works in Hollywood movies. And then basically at the end of the meeting, they were like, hey, the director really likes you. Do you want to do this? And I said, let me think about it. You know, let's keep talking. So after a couple months of going back and forth, we figured out a deal and I agreed to do it. And it was really exciting to come on board after watching the first movie and kind of just understanding just a tiny bit about Chinese cinema and where they're at. it was, hey, meet with this director to kind of help him understand how in the Hollywood setting, how scores work. But, oh, why don't you score the movie? It was really great. Yeah.
Watching the first Wolf Warrior in that process, kind of like your first sort of exposure to Chinese film.
Yes, it was. I mean, obviously, I've seen some classic Chinese cinema, but in terms of modern Chinese cinema, you know, that was the first modern Chinese movie I've really been exposed to.
What was your first impression of Wu Jing? What was he like? Because we only see him, you know, on screen as the Wolf Warrior, essentially.
Well, you, like, know, off-screen? You know that energy he brings on screen is very similar to his energy off screen. I mean, he's not as physically active off screen, obviously, but in terms of his dedication and mental stamina and desire to make something amazing, that's all there. And that's why I was excited to sign on. I saw a director who wasn't just trying to make a movie and be a star. He was trying to make a great movie and dedicate himself to being a great performer. So when you see that in a potential collaborator, you have nothing, you know, what goes through my mind, there's nothing but the desire to help them achieve something amazing, you know? So that energy kind of ran throughout the project, throughout my relationship to him. And through this day, I saw him maybe about a year ago, we had dinner kind of celebrating the success of Wolf Warrior 2. And he was already, you know, I could tell he's starting to think about what's next. And so that's something that is super positive and super exciting.
Yeah. How did he present his initial vision for the sound of the movie, for the music in the movie?
That's what was really interesting. I think being someone coming from Hollywood, they were looking to me to bring something to the table for them to work with. So when they first gave me the movie, there was no temp score. There was no general direction other than we want this to be a big movie and have kind of the touches that Hollywood is accustomed to. We want this to look and sound and feel like a real Hollywood movie. And so that was very interesting. It was, you know, it's a little concerning to me coming to a scenario where there is no direction, but the direction was there in terms of like, size this up, make it big, make it powerful. They gave me a budget to work with an orchestra, to have a team, to like have all my usual stuff. So they really enabled me to do a great job, which is really cool.
Did you stay in California for most of this process, or were you over there as well?
I went over there once during the shoot to just kind of sit down with Wu Jing and the producers to kind of just continue our conversation. They visited me several times here in LA to listen to music, to have meetings, that sort of thing. But the majority of the process was remote. And that is something that is very interesting. I think if I were to do this whole scenario again, I do hope to score another Chinese movie in the future. But if I were to do it over again, I think I would hire a translator to allow them to speak in Mandarin, because Wu Jing has surprisingly good English. He claims not to have good English, but he is very good English. He just doesn't like using it so much. But his producer and the associate producer, so they speak very good English. So I spoke to them exclusively in English. But, and again, this is something I learned during the process, that's kind of limiting for a creative person to work their second language. So, for instance, I was talking to the sound team at Park Road Post in New Zealand. They handled the sound mix, and they were having trouble kind of communicating, getting the right notes, and they wound up hiring a Mandarin speaker, local Mandarin speaker, to be the translator, which allowed the crew to talk in Mandarin, and their notes became much clearer and much, much more forthcoming. And that was something that definitely was a challenge for me, understanding the notes, understanding what they wanted exactly. So that was definitely something I learned from the project, is next time I do a Chinese movie to have a translator so I could allow them to feel super comfortable. Just like I said to a director the other day, I said, more importantly than what you love, I need you to tell me what you hate. You know, I need you to tell me, like, I deliver music, I'm giving you music. Tell me what you don't like about it, because then I'll never do that again. I'll learn like what you really like and what you don't like, you know. And that was definitely one of the challenges here, was overcoming the translation.
That one time that you did get to the studio, you know, when you were in China, what was the feel like on the set? I mean, was there like the energy of, you know, we're making, you know, a movie that's going to make $1 billion?
Well, that's a great question. I had heard going into this, I was told, and my knowledge of Chinese politics and current culture is very poor. I'm a typical American. I'm not super internationally knowledgeable. I try to be, but China is particularly not a forte of mine. But I heard stuff like, oh, the first movie was made for like $10 million and made $90 million. It was this giant hit. And the president of China was so into it and said, I can't wait for the sequel. You know, so you're hearing that going, wow, this could be a big movie. But I've done a lot of movies at this point, and really the thing you have to know as a creator is that you have to derive your pleasure, or your you have to derive your sense of purpose from the actual job itself, because so many times we work on a movie, we pour everything into it and the movie fails and nobody goes to see it, you know? So, and the movie makes no money. So if you connect your own internal sense of success or failure with box office, you're in for a world of hurt. So I'm just going, hey, I just want to make this sound cool. And for the people who see it, I want them to go, wow, that music's really cool. And even more importantly, this film is really cool. So on set, it was surprisingly similar to the times I've been on set here in the States. It's a whole bunch of people. They were in the middle of nowhere, 2 hours outside of Beijing, but had built this like little city up on a set and had all these cars and vehicles. And Wu Jing was working around the clock to like not only in front of the camera, but behind the camera, obviously. You know, I have to say it was very similar to a Hollywood movie set in the sense that everyone there was dedicated to making something awesome. I think that's kind of a through line that you'll find throughout cinema, throughout the arts. People are getting paid, you know, are making a living, but also it's such a brutal lifestyle with working around the clock that the people who do it are just into it for loving movies, for loving cinema. So I wasn't surprised by that because that's a very common thing for me to see, but it was, again, something that made me smile because I wasn't sure what to expect in China. But, you know, I found it more similar to Hollywood than I thought it was going to be.
You mentioned the politics of the movie, which I find particularly interesting. Were you thinking at all about it being a politically important movie in that way for China while you were thinking up the score? Did that play into your composition process?
Well, you know, that's a great line of thinking. I think there are two ways to go about this job that I have. You know, one way is to kind of be completely just focused on the piano or whatever you're looking at to write music and just making great music. But obviously, we live in a society and you need to kind of think of the bigger picture, you know, in terms of like, what is my music going to bring to this film? What is it going to add to the film that will enhance it for the audience? So when I saw the original Wolf Warrior, what struck me was it felt very much like an 80s Hollywood movie. And after kind of talking to the producers, talking to some other people about Chinese cinema, it seems that where Chinese cinema is right now, at least psychologically, is where America was in the 80s. This kind of rah-rah, like, you know, super patriotic. For the U.S., it was like Rocky versus the USSR. Rambo versus the USSR. Yeah, exactly.
Just yesterday.
And I think, look, again, I really am not an expert here, but it certainly felt like China versus the world in terms of that cinema is like China establishing itself as a true, powerful world influencer. So for me as a composer, what that really told me more than anything else is just I need the music to be uplifting and inspiring and make people feel confident in coming together and uniting to overcome a challenge. You know, I try to boil things down to its most basic and leave the actual nitty-gritty of the politics out of it. You know, you can't help but think of it from time to time, obviously, but as an artist, I'm trying to just kind of boil it down to just simply making great music, you know?
Totally.
In contrast with the like uplifting kind of energy that you wanted to bring into this, personally, I wanted to ask about that song in the cave with like that acoustic guitar that I guess Wu Jing has some voiceover on.
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest with you, I had nothing to do with that song. You know? So all I knew was they had brought in a really top songwriter in China to write that song and Wu Jing was going to sing it. That's what I was told. And I didn't really hear it until, like, you know, there was some talk early on that maybe I could write a theme that the song could be based on, or this, or I could base like the love theme on the song or something like that. And unfortunately, the way schedules work, things got so compressed where that didn't happen. So my first exposure to the song was when I was basically done with the score and they had sent it to me and said, oh, here's the song, you know, and it's a cool, beautiful song, you know, but unfortunately I didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah. Reza and I were chatting earlier. It's like comparable to Gran Torino, but you know, a bit better in terms of singing than Clint Eastwood, maybe.
So out of nowhere, you know, but it's kind of beautiful in its sense.
Well,
it's
and a I think strange scene. And again, I think yet again, it's another kind of parallel to the 80s. I mean, it reminds me of how music was used in the 80s, where all of a sudden a song would just here out of nowhere. Like, where did this come from? And, you know, it's not a judgment on the song. It's just like, oh, okay, and now this, you know? So I think it's very similar, you know? And I think it is really interesting, right, that China gets all the biggest Hollywood movies of modern day, of, you know, the Marvel stuff or whatever, but their actual movies right now are kind of 30 years in the past, kind of catching up. At least that's what it seemed like when I did it. I think you guys might know this better than me. How many movie theaters are opening a day in China? I mean, it's I think it's like 4 theaters a day year round for like the last however many years are opening. So I think they're going to catch up with us quickly. And I think what'll be really interesting is what Chinese cinema is like 10 years from now. I think it might be right up to snuff with us just because they're moving so fast and the cultural crossover is accelerating and becoming a thing. But I know that politically right now there are people trying to put a wall in between, so to speak, a theoretical wall in between China and the US. So you wonder if that will kind of prevent future collaborations. Like if Wolf Warrior 2 was happening today, I'm not sure if I would have been hired because, you know, right now the political tensions between the US and China are so much. Unlike, you know, I think what makes us lucky here in the States, we have obviously free speech, so Hollywood can do whatever they want, whereas cinema in China is heavily, heavily controlled. I was unfortunately not around at the final dub in New Zealand, but I did hear it got really tense at the end with the censors watching Wolf Warrior 2 and giving notes to Wu Jing about things that need to be changed, need to be ADR'd, redubbed so that it would fit in line with the party. So I think I can't speak to any specifics just because I don't know it, but sure. I did hear it got really stressful at the end from people who I know. So I think what's so interesting, I'm used to getting notes from the director, the producer, maybe the studio, but you know, in China, they get notes from the government. Right. So I don't even want to imagine that stress. So I think it's just like Hollywood, but with that added thing. So that's going to be very interesting to see moving forward how that guides the development of Chinese cinema. I'm sure you've had other guests talk about it. I'm not an expert on that. That's the last thing I really want to talk about.
To get into the specifics of the score, though, what I was very interested in was that it seems like the music interacts in an interesting way with the bullet shots as like a rhythmic element. Was that something that you were thinking about while making it?
It was, you know, I think it was very clear that Wu Jing wanted to incorporate some very stylized cinematography and shooting techniques into his movie. So when I approached those scenes and those edits, I tried to make sure that we were pacing correctly with the type of editing and the type of shooting they were using. I mean, that's something I try to do on every film, is to kind of try to find the inherent rhythm of the scene, rhythm of the editing, the performance, and then try to match that. You know, I think on Wolf Warrior 2 was pretty chaotic at the end of the day. I think some of the score got jiggered around where a piece of score from one scene was actually used for a different scene. It was very interesting because there was the post-production schedule got tighter and tighter and tighter. So there's some parts of the movie where I went to see it in the theater and, you know, I had kind of forgotten that music was used for this scene because it was moved around. But that happens in film all the time, you know.
Were there any like very particular sources of inspiration for the score? I'm talking maybe more like cultural sounds. I mean, the movie takes place mainly in like an African setting and there seems to be inspiration there too.
There absolutely is. I use quite a bit of African instrumentation, especially on the percussion side of things. For me personally, it's interesting. I tried to, especially with this movie being Caucasian American, coming in to score a Chinese film. I had been to China once about 4 months before starting on Wolf Warrior 2, and then I went again during the shoot. So obviously, again, I try to be cultured and worldly, but also I'm very aware of my own shortcomings. So when it comes to doing a quote-unquote ethnic score and pulling in ethnic instrumentation, that was something I deliberately, with the exception of some African instrumentation, I really tried to stay as far away from as possible and try to make this a universal score, if that makes sense. You know, try to kind of, you know, let the scenery, let the cinematography be Africa, be China, and then have the score itself be the internal emotions rather than the external setting, if that makes sense.
Totally. It was like super well integrated. We were talking about how well the movie is paced, kind of like, it at least personally, it reminded me of like a good Bourne or
one of the good Batmans where you just can't take a second off, and the score really kept up with that. So that was,
although
that
it did have its like soaring moments, I would say much more so than a Bourne or a John Wick.
Well, and what's interesting about that, you know, I have to say that was one of the reasons why I wanted to do this film, because I'm a child of the 80s. I grew up with 80s movies. So when I kind of saw how parallel current Chinese cinema is with cinema of Hollywood of the 80s, I knew there would be these soaring moments and moments where I could write a big theme. I think what's interesting about modern Hollywood filmmaking is it's very allergic to melodies and thematic moments. I can't tell you how many times I've tried to, you know, one of these big soaring themes into a movie, and the director or the producer or the studio just looks at me like I'm insane, you know. So I think not only was I able to use current practice and what my training is at contemporary Hollywood scoring, but then indulge myself a little bit in the music that I grew up with, which has these soaring melodic moments. And so that's something that the producers actually, you know, one of the producers especially encouraged from the beginning, to have these soaring melodic moments. And that's, yeah, it really made it pleasurable for me to do that, because I don't get to do that normally.
I mean, you get these scenes where, like, you're kind of getting chased by a tank. I mean, you definitely need, like, an intense score at that moment. So, I mean, that totally works out.
Good, good.
It seems like this score is also a lot less electronic than some of the other stuff you've done. Although maybe there's more electronic elements that I'm not hearing. But was that also an element of that sort of nostalgia?
That absolutely. But part of the element of nostalgia was, like, yeah, really focusing on a muscular orchestra, kind of using the orchestra to kind of give you the meat and the potatoes of the score. There's plenty of synths kind of reinforcing stuff and kind of creating a fat low end and all sort of stuff that we use synths to do, kind of make it more punchy. But in terms of the general instrumentation, you're exactly right. It's quite a bit less electronic than what I'm used to doing. So that was kind of fun to do something that is more straight orchestral. But also, you know, I have to be careful with synths, because if I push too hard, it could feel sci-fi or futuristic. So, you know, it's definitely designed to be less synth heavy than some of my other music.
And also, there was like a good amount of diegetic music in the movie as well. For instance, there's that party scene where it seems like it's only music being played on drums within the scene. Were you also involved in that sort of thing?
I was and I wasn't. You know, I love being involved early, and I was involved early on this film, getting a very early script, thankfully in English that I could understand, which is impressive for them to translate it, because they didn't have to. But that was cool that they did that for me, and for, I guess, the rest of the there were obviously, as you know, a number of Americans involved, so that was cool of them to do that for us. But so I knew about these scenes, we'd spoken about them. But what's interesting is, where Chinese movie making is on a nuts and bolts level, they're still kind of figuring things out in terms of how to make stuff work logistically like that. So, for instance, I worked on a movie here in the States recently that had a lot of on-screen music. And so I was engaged very early on to do some pre-recording and to fly to a studio where we had access to Dixieland musicians and, like, go in and record authentic Dixieland and bring in a singer and bring in the, you know, and then on set they had a playback engineer and the actors had earwigs so that they can, like, sync up with the music and, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas on Wolf Warrior 2 with the diegetic music, it was this question mark the whole time. Like, I was like, I remember asking, like, how are you going to do this? Do you need me to provide drums? And do you need me to provide, you know, and I never got a clear answer until we basically, the movie was done and I was sent like a drum track, like, oh, these are the drums that we did on set. And it was a bit messy, and luckily we had a great music editor who was able to make something work and put it together, and I think he found some local music where they're based in New Zealand. He found some local musicians to kind of fill in some gaps. So it's like this really interesting, like, you know, I admire the tenacity to, like, like, look, they made a gigantic movie, but at the same time, like, there were these basic questions that they just haven't established that sort of production technique of, like, what a pre-record is. And, you know, I would try to educate them and try to help, but at the same time, you know, I'm just the composer, so I could nudge, I could offer advice and thoughts and that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, you just got to get it done with the resources at hand. So that was super interesting, and I knew it was going to be a challenge going into it, and it was. But again, luckily we had a great music editor, a great mix team, so I didn't have to worry about it that much, thankfully.
sort of a more broad question. I think a lot of Chinese blockbusters do, as obviously you did with this one, do take sort of notes from more Hollywood movies. Do you think that the music will start becoming more distinctively Chinese in Chinese blockbusters? Do you see that happening?
Well, first of all, I would love that. I think I saw Wolf Warrior 2 as an opportunity for me to share the culture I've grown up with generation of Chinese artists. Hopefully, you know, Chinese musicians are taking something away from that and learning like modern production technique. That would be so cool if that were to happen. That's something I was very vocal about when we started, that, you know, we've even talked about I need to get in touch with again, but the producer and I have spoken about maybe doing a film music workshop in China. I think that would be awesome, you know, because I think having, obviously, you know, what do I know about Chinese culture? How awesome would it be for the next Wolf Warrior to be scored by a Chinese musician, you know, and to have a distinctly Chinese voice? That being said, it is interesting whereas, you know, I had a quick turnaround on a film recently where from spotting to dubbing, meaning from when I first saw the movie through when we were mixing the music in with the dialogue, it was about 10 weeks. And that's pretty fast. That's like 2 hours of music in 10 weeks. You do the math. Yeah. It's a lot of hard work. I've heard that a lot of, and this is Asian cinema in general, because it's made very quickly. Mm. And the production values is slightly lower. I've heard of that it's not unusual for a composer to have 2 weeks to score a film. Hello. And so when you watch Asian cinema, some of it that has a lower production value, and you hear the score and you say, why is this just like random drum loops and kind of bad? You can't just blame the composer. You could go, well, if they had 2 weeks to do it, like, and they wrote like an hour and a half of music in 2 weeks, I mean, that's amazing. Good for them. But until we see a more traditional post-production pipeline, in the sense of like you give the composer at least 2 months to deliver a score, ideally 4 months or 6 months, where the composer can really deliver something great, that's when I think we're going to see something really artistic and really special happening, you know. And luckily with Wu Jing and this team, they realized the power of music, like what music is bringing to them, so they gave me the time and resources to do a proper score. But for a lot of Asian cinema, it seems that, and again, this is overgeneralizing. Mm. There are plenty of examples where this is not the case, but, you know, a lot of times music is an afterthought. So I think if we see music becoming more artistic and more driven by culture there, it'll be because they're given more time and resources to deliver the art that this is. It is an art. It's not just a catering or something. Yeah. But I think it's treated like catering sometimes. We're used to that. We know that's a possibility. But for it to be a really artistic thing, it has to be treated like a work of art, if that makes sense.
It does. Have you heard any rumblings about another Wolf Warrior?
You know, I think that's something that is absolutely planned and something that Wu Jing wants to have happen. I think it's a question of where it fits in his schedule. And, you know, you saw that teaser at the end of Wolf Warrior.
Oh, yeah.
So I think without a doubt, we're going to see a Wolf Warrior 3. I think it's just a matter of when. And to be honest with you, I haven't heard from the guys in a few months. So you're reminding me, maybe I should email them and say hello up and just say, hey, how's it going? I have yet to see Wandering Earth.
It's so good.
And an amazing score Chinese composer, yeah.
Oh, good. Good. That will make me happy. So I'm looking forward to checking that out. Thank you.
Yeah, that one. These are the two, like Wolf Warrior 2 and Wandering Earth, that are just like really,
and they're both Wu Jing.
They really
jump
out at you. Of course, Wu Jing. Yeah, we're developing like a weird sort of cult of personality for him, just on our little podcast, but it's unavoidable.
And I have to admit, I mean, Wu Jing really is an inspiration for me, because, you know, here's a guy who's been working hard for 20 plus years as an actor, you know, having bit roles here and getting a few breaks here and there. He started in Hong Kong cinema, which I understand is very different from Chinese cinema. And, you know, making that crossover from Hong Kong cinema to Chinese cinema is not an easy thing, but he did it and worked his way up through Chinese cinema. And so for him to see him here, and not only is he's not resting on any laurels, he's not, you know, like the last time I saw him after the wild success of Wolf Warrior 2, he was talking about how excited he was to go back to the gym and like go this next movie and go, you know, like, so he is someone who works so hard. So every little piece of success he has come via blood and sweat and just working crazy hard. So he really is an inspiration for me.
Thanks to Joseph Trapanese, here's our conversation with Wolf Warrior 2 action director Sam Hargrave.
Our show is basically, we're doing a series right now on like the top 10 biggest Chinese blockbusters. And the show generally is about Chinese blockbusters. And this is sort of the culmination of the season. And in fact, I think yours might be the last interview of the season.
Is that because we had the biggest movie?
No. Exactly.
It's also the movie that absolutely inspired the show.
Yeah, totally. We saw the movie and we were like, we have to learn all about Chinese blockbusters after this.
Oh, wow. Okay, well.
Unfortunately, the rest of the list doesn't stack up to this one.
not quite.
Well, but I'm just honored to be on any list whatsoever when it comes to cinema, so I appreciate you guys considering.
God, I mean, this is one of the best movies like of the decade.
Honestly, yeah. It's really up there.
Oh, glad you guys liked it.
So we wanted to start off talking about, it seems like Hong Kong's stunt culture has had a really big influence on Hollywood stunt culture. And in this movie, you were sort of looping it back.
Yeah.
Did you grow up on like Hong Kong stuff?
I did. I grew up, I started martial arts, my training in martial arts when I was probably 13 or 14 years old. And that introduced me to that culture, and Jackie Chan and Bruce Lee, Jet Li movies were very soon on the menu for me to devour, and I loved them. I mean, I always tended to gravitate towards Jackie Chan's style just because I love humor and action, his editing, and he always really impressed me. But you know, Donnie Yen is always pushing the envelope, and I'm not nearly as rabid a fan as I was back in my, you know, younger years, but I try to keep up with the current, you know, any movies coming out of Hong Kong or even Korea. Like,
bringing it up to Donnie Yen, that almost, like, if you were watching earlier Donnie Yen, right, that would have been like, or not early Donnie Yen, but like you would have seen Wu Jing and Killzone, right?
Oh yeah, no, I loved Wu Jing and Killzone. That was fantastic. I was definitely aware going into the movie that was one of the, you know, super intriguing things about it, is to get to work with Wu Jing, because he stood out in that scene, and we'd always try to emulate, you know, what we saw, and that was impetus for a lot of our online videos starting out, and it really heavily influenced my work and thought process on action sequences.
Oh, wow. So how is working with an actor who is, you know, already originally a martial artist, like in terms of doing stunts and stuff?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's very refreshing. I've been very fortunate in my career, both, you know, in Hollywood and outside of it, to get paired up with some pretty talented actors physically, you know, like Hugh Jackman or Chris Hemsworth, Chris Evans. They're all super talented, but they don't have the many, many years of discipline, the martial disciplines that the Wu Jing had. And I mean, he's like, you know, was one of the highest level competitors at the time in China. He's like a legend in martial arts alone. So to work with him and to see, he just not only picks up choreography insanely fast, he comes up with ideas where you go, oh, that's a fantastic idea. I never thought of that. Like, how did you do that? Show me that so I can, you know, learn that and use that in another movie.
One like super specific thing that I noticed that came up in both Killzone, the first Wolf Warrior, and this one is this tiny curved knife that he has. Yeah. Was that something he like specifically brought up?
He likes knives. He likes weapons, obviously. For this one, he wanted to keep it very military. But he really does like the karambit is like that style of knife. It's a kind of a very regional weapon to that side of the world, and it's very unique, and it hasn't been used in a lot of movies. I mean, they made it very famous in The Raid, or at least The Raid 2, but he wanted to just put like a different, you know, a different spin on it and his own style to it, and I think he did a great job.
Totally. How did you first hear about the second Wolf Warrior?
Yeah, I got brought onto the project by the Russo brothers. So Wu Jing was looking to up the ante from the first Wolf Warrior. He had to, you know, make a bigger splash, and he wanted to collaborate with some U.S. filmmakers because he wanted to, he said, you know, figured they you know, he didn't just want to do a martial arts action movie. He wanted to do guns and fights and vehicles. And so he's like, who does that better than Hollywood? And, you know, we had just finished, or I had finished coordinating the Civil War. He came to L.A. and met with the Russo brothers because, you know, they directed it. So he's like, hey, who did your action? And, you know, that was me. And strangely enough, truthfully, the first call I got was to direct the movie.
Oh, wow.
Whoa.
And I turned it down because at the time, I'm always interested, but I'd like to see a script and just see what the story is. So at the time, it was basically a 30-page outline. So there was, you know, and with just story was all over the place. And I was like, oh, this is going to take a lot of work. But they're like, oh, we want to shoot it in 3 months' time. And I'm like, whew.
Oh, yeah.
A team of writers and, you know, at least that much time to kind of sort this thing out. So I said, I got to pass. And so I just passed on the project and they, you know, were like, okay. And then they came back and said, well, would you just action direct it? And then I thought about it and I was like, that'd be like fun, work with Wu Jing and get to go to China, which I hadn't been to yet. And it would just be a fun challenge. Let's do it. And so I signed on, but it was through the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony Russo, who I got introduced to Wu Jing in that whole process.
What was it like being in China for your first time on like such a big set?
I mean, China was a very memorable experience. Like it was, you know, before that I'd worked in South Africa and kind of all over the globe, but China was a very unique experience. It was a lot of people over there.
Yeah.
And it's just a very, you know, they're very passionate about film. They're just a little, you know, as far as the process, their, you know, the gear and understanding of how a lot of that stuff works, they're a little bit behind the States, the Western cinema in that regard. But their passion and their, you know, love for movies and figuring stuff out that, you know, equals, if not exceeds, those of Hollywood.
With that sort of being a little bit behind, and I've also heard that their filmmaking can be a little bit haphazard in a way.
Yeah.
Were you at all worried about safety on that set?
Oh, safety was paramount for me. And you mentioned earlier the kind of, you know, coming up, being influenced by Hong Kong cinema and that kind of action, and then kind of coming full circle. So I brought, you know, from the States and Canada, I brought an entire team with me, like an action team.
Oh, wow.
And who just helped me design and execute all of the stunts and action. And the biggest task that I, you know, gave them was safety. Just like keep your eyes open because things are, you know, they are a little bit loose. Just a lot of it's just they don't know. They haven't been exposed to these kind of more modern safety measures. We had a great group of guys from the U.S. and Canada who were tasked with keeping everything safe. You know, I wasn't overall in charge of that, but I had a great team of guys and girls over there helping me out. And we did. We had to keep our eyes open because they're very loose over there. And I think a lot of it just stems from them not having the knowledge or experience in a lot of these different action scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just had, there was a lot of, you know, exposure issue. And so we just had to, we exposed them to a lot of kind of more advanced safety measures, and we taught them a lot of things, and they're very willing to learn. There's no, you know, not a huge ego over there of being like, oh, well, this is how we do it. They're like, oh, that's great. We didn't really think of it that way. Yeah, we tried to help.
Was there anything flowing in the other direction that you learned from them?
Technically, no, but the what I did learn culturally, and Wu Jing was great about this, about being able to understand his target audience and mixing just enough Western flavor, but staying true to kind of Chinese culture and traditional cinema. So things, for example, things that in the Western world, and I, you know, would fight for this stuff because I'm like, oh, I'm making we want it to be Western, we're going to make Western cinema. I would fight for very kind of reserved and subdued take, very subtle. Everything in the West is like, acting wise, very subtle. Whereas it's a little more on the nose. They're a little more theatrical about things, but that really translates well for that audience. That's what they know and love. And so, and he, I mean, to the tune of, you know, almost $900 million, he obviously knew his market very well. Just crushed the, you know, just crushed that, the whole tonal experience of that film, and really honed it. He really knew. He had a very keen sense of what his audience wanted.
I was noticing that came out in the action too. Like there's one shot where he catches a shard of glass and just slices someone with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which it just seemed like a clear example of like, this movie is
heightened in ways that are maybe not on the surface.
I mean, he also captures like a missile with a mattress.
Right.
Yes, mattress he does. So, you know, and it's funny because you can very clearly see where his ideas would live and where more of our, you know, the kind of Western ideas live. And what he did, I think, with my hat's off to him, what he did so, I think, did so well is mixing the two. Because, you know, it wasn't like the sensibilities, say, like in the fight in the marketplace, or like the, you know, the shootout, some of the shootouts or the car chase, that was very Western sensibilities. But then to mix just enough flavor of jumping down and grabbing on with one hand the chain and using the your other hand the glass to slice a throat, or catching an RPG like the rocket propel grenade with a box spring mattress and then tossing to the side and blowing up a car, that's very kind of Hong Kong Chinese cinema. But he just, you know, he did it like with, again, just the right mixture. He knew what people wanted to see, and he was the chef making it all happen back there.
Have drones ever been a part of your stunt work in such a direct way as it was in this movie? Especially that one scene where Lang
jumping,
takes a drone
from a bus,
down with
yeah.
like a bat or something.
Yeah. Burning.
I mean, not in like a story way as much as this one, which I thought was really creative when it was working on. You know, it went from should the Roach character, should they be a bunch of like toy trucks like coming in from the ground, or like RC cars, or should they be drones? And then, you know, he's like, but the idea of these drones swarming and, you know, having explosives and guns and him taking them out of the sky would be really creative. And I couldn't disagree. It is. I've never really seen that, you know, you've seen drones before used for different things. And there's more advanced military drones in different movies. But to have a guy like jumping off a bus and squatting up an AK-47, like that's pretty neat. I thought it was pretty cool.
What goes through your mind when you hear that there's going to be a tank fight in a movie?
Not only a tank fight, but man versus tank for parts.
Mostly I go like, wow, like how the F are we going to do that? And what's crazy is, it's just amazing, is like they built those tanks.
Oh, wow.
So they had you know, Wu Jing is in with the Chinese military because from the first one, so he's got a lot of you know, friends over there and people he knows, and they help him out. But there's a guy who his kind of hobby is he makes tanks, like replica tanks.
Wow.
And so he made these tanks that we could flip over or blow up and a little faster than normal tanks, so we could do some of the, you know, the drivings, the quote driving stuff. Because how he pitched it to me, Wu Jing's like, I want to do like Fast and Furious, but with tanks. And I was like, okay, all right, man. All right. Well, we're gonna give it a go. And so, you know, we had a lot of fun with it, but that was very challenging. And Wu Jing, in a lot of those sequences, is actually driving the tank. He learned to drive the tank. It wasn't a double for most of that stuff. He wanted to do almost everything himself.
Wow. Did he ever get hurt like doing these things? I mean, this is incredible.
He got banged up, never hurt, like injured so where he couldn't film, but he got banged up. He was rolling around, like, you know, banged up his knees. He fell down a couple times. He had a bruised rib. So, like, you know, he was just, I mean, not to be kind of dismissive of it, but kind of normal action hero stuff, you know. We had a stunt double there for him, so he wasn't doing everything because it was a long shoot and he had a lot of big action to do. And I come from like the Jackie Chan school of stunts, meaning like if it's a big stunt or a big gag that you're going to see his face and it's going to make the movie better, let's use him. But if, you know, if you're behind the character and you don't see his face and it's just like a fall or some gnarly crazy thing, use the stunt double because that's what they're for. That's what they get paid for. Mm-hmm. But he wanted as much as possible to photograph it in a way where you see his face and he can do as much as possible.
We were talking to the composer of the movie, it must have been a week ago now, but he was telling us that, like, late on in the process, the movie ran into some censorship issues, but I know that contemporary violence is one thing that really sets off Chinese censors. Were there any conversations about that when you were planning the stunts?
Yes and no. Like, he was trying to hit, and he think he did a good job, but hit a very specific audience. He wanted what he called the hyper-realism of Hollywood action, where he want, you know, you mentioned like the John Wicks and, you know, the war movies, like a Spielberg war movie where you're really feeling it, which would be pushing the envelope for Chinese cinema. Like, because it's, you know, they don't get a lot of that kind of violence. There's a lot of martial arts kind of violence, but not with guns, you know, and missiles and stuff like that. So we were aware of it, but we were kind of tasked by Wu Jing to push the envelope. And he's like, I'll try to work with the censors. He just wanted to do something different. He wanted, and I think he got it, the Chinese Rambo, basically.
Totally. Did he use that phrase?
We started, like, we were, I mean, he didn't necessarily, but we started, I don't know who, it was the first person to mention it, but it just felt like that, because it's, you know, he's this military guy who, you know, kind of goes out on his own to save people, and he's using a lot of bullets and a lot of, he's blowing up a lot of things to do it, so we basically coined him the Chinese Rambo.
It's kind of interesting, too, because Rambo is such an example of the politics of the 80s. And I think Wolf Warrior 2, in an interesting way, is like the Chinese politics of today.
Yeah.
And most of the time when we bring up with like academics or something that aren't the politics of Wolf Warrior 2 interesting, they immediately jump in with this like sort of parenthetical almost of like, but American movies are political, too. And interestingly, they almost immediately bring up the Avengers usually.
Yeah.
Do you think about the like politics on these movies? Like, did you experience them in different ways while working on them?
Well, it's funny. It's, and so much of that I think is culturally grounded or culturally based. It very much felt like a political movie working on Wolf Warrior 2. Mm-hmm. It just had a very specific thing to say about China's position globally and then their interaction with other countries. And there's even, you know, mention with, you know, of GIs and American military, just references to them. I feel it less in movies like The Avengers, at least when you're working on it. Although there is a very strong, you know, correlations and subtextual references that you can't help but notice. I just think it's because culturally you're in that country. You know, when you're in the States working on a movie that's about superheroes, so it's already in kind of the metaphorical realm because it's, you know, fantasy because of superheroes. Whereas you've got a more real world scenario with a movie like Wolf Warrior, and then you're in a foreign country where you're more aware of the difference in politics. So I think it was more obvious working on that it was related to political stances than working on a movie like Avengers.
It was the ship at the beginning. Was that like a mock-up of a ship or was that in cooperation with, the military over there lending a ship or something?
For which shot? The one they were...
Like, at the very beginning, he runs, he just, you know, kind of spreads his arms and jumps, dives off the ship.
No, that was an actual ship. Yeah, that was not a fake ship. Ran and jumped off the side of a ship.
How, that's like the impact of jumping off a ship like that. How do you mitigate that?
Well, it's crazy the amount of like training he put into it. He did a lot of work with, because we did, I mean, to kind of back this up, that leads into the, you know, when he jumps off the ship, it leads into this, quote, underwater wonder. And how that came about, hilariously, is he, Wu Jing had this idea that, you know, it opens on in the beginning, he's got this fight and he wants to do a fight on deck and then a fight underwater. And I was like, oh, that's cool. But what if when he goes in the water, it's more the fight action takes place more on the deck of the ship. And then once he jumps, it's kind of that the last exclamation point where he jumps in. They don't know where he is. And he knocks the guys off the boat. And then that's his the end of the thing. I said, and I pitched to him, I said, it'd be really cool. What if we did, and I just did this, you know, a couple years ago on this movie, Atomic Blonde. What if we did this long kind of one shot thing where you introduce the character and he's doing this great fight and then following over the edge, he jumps in the water and then that's the end of the one shot. And then he thought about it and he's like, I like the idea. We should do the underwater fight, but as a oneer with no cut. And then I was kind of like, oh boy, I just stuck my foot in my mouth, didn't I? And so this idea had been planted in his head. So now, you know, there I was, we had to design an underwater oneer. So, you know, we were choreographing fights in pools, and he started training. We found this guy who does breath work, and this free diver is like world record free diver. And so he was going to this tank every couple of days every week before filming and doing his underwater, you know, it's all this deep breathing above and then holding his breath. He got to where he could hold his breath underwater for over 3 minutes.
Wow.
So that, you know, when we filmed the bit underwater, and we did this at a pool in outside of Beijing, and we were shot there, that underwater sequence for like 5 or 6 days. And so he would, you know, he was doing all that. So he would, you know, we'd be above water. He would take his, you know, just do his breathing, take a big breath, and under he went, and he would do these extended fight sequences underwater, you know, on a single breath. His commitment to the craft was incredible.
One thing that's sort of interesting about him is like, I think in some of his like very early movies, he was just kind of working, doing stunts and also just more just martial arts and having transitioned into directing. Do you see that as a sort of parallel in what you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, he did it. Well, I guess we're yet to see, my movie hasn't come out, but he was extremely successful. His first movie, like he made it, you know, I don't know, the budget was very low and he made like $100 million. And then he even did it better with Wolf Warrior 2. He made it for, I don't know exactly, but it was a lot more than he made the first one for. But the return, like they made, I think it was almost $900 million in China alone. So, yeah, he has proven he crushed it. He from going from stunts to, you know, as an actor and then to directing seemed like a very natural progression. He was, you know, he was good at it. He knows what he wants to see. He knows how to talk to, at least in, you know, the Chinese performers. He knows how to like talk to those guys and get what he wants. And I think especially with action, he was very gracious to bring us in, and because he knows what he's doing with action too. He just wanted a different flavor, and he was very humble and said, "Hey, I want to see what you guys come up with." And he had ideas, of course, but I think it's another testament to the stuntman turned director that, you know, Chad Stahelski and David Leitch have done as well in America. But he is doing kind of running a parallel path in China. And I think it's awesome. I think it's really great to not just assume that these people who are physically talented and creative, that's all they can do. Like there's a lot more they have to offer the world of cinema.
Do you think as stunt performers becoming directors, you have a better idea of sort of what the actual limits are as opposed to the imagined limits of what you can do on screen?
I think that has... that plays a part for sure. And I think the, you know, the thing that is mostly important and has been done effectively by these, you know, folks we've been talking about, the Stahelskis and Leeches and Wu Jings, is you just because they do action doesn't mean you can forego telling a good story. That's the most important thing. And I think they understand, so because, you know, martial arts has this kind of rhythm and you know, history and storytelling through action that they have a lot of experience at doing. And then I guess you could kind of toss me in that category, just that through years of, you know, doing these fight sequences and trying to tell stories through action, it gives you an understanding of storytelling and understanding the importance of storytelling, that you don't have a fight scene without it. Like if two people are just punching each other for no reason, we don't care. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you enter story and stakes and action and consequences, then you have an interesting fight scene. And so that, I think that has been super helpful for these, you know, stuntmen turned, you know, directors or action directors first, and then legit first unit directors. That's a very helpful background to come from.
Did he ever bring up, you know, like the potential of exporting this movie at all? I mean, obviously he knows like his domestic market, but throughout the movie, they end up speaking a lot of English. Yeah. Did that ever come up? Like,
yeah, no, he wanted to make a movie that would be as international as they could. I don't know, you know, how, I haven't kept track of it, how it's done internationally, but I know that was definitely talked about. He wanted to have, because he would love to break into the U.S. market as an actor and filmmaker. And so he wanted to have something that had, just think, showed that he understood that market a little bit. Definitely talked about on set, and we would do takes where it was, to all an all Chinese version of a scene, but then we'd also do like an English version.
Oh wow! Were you involved in like directing the American actors more so, or like was anyone helping him out? Because it just seems like in the first movie, a lot of the lines in English aren't delivered in a super
compelling way.
Yeah, it seems a little bit unnatural in the first movie, but in the second movie, that's a huge improvement.
Yeah, I did actually. I pretty much directed all of Frank Grillo's scenes.
Oh, wow. Nice. Those are so good.
Yeah, because Frank and I mean, we go way back and we had like a rapport, and for whatever reason, Wu Jing and Frank, their communication just wasn't super smooth at times. And so I kind of I helped out, and then it kind of transitioned. And we also would split up because there was a lot of stuff to shoot. So sometimes it would work out that Wu Jing had to go, you know, do some other big scenes, and he'd like, hey, go shoot this thing with Frank. I don't want him to, you know, to wait around. So, oh, sure. So I go shoot a lot of stuff with Frank.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Maybe it's method acting that they didn't get along.
Maybe. I don't know, who knows? I think it's probably part of it. They were like, oh, we're enemies in the we're not going to get along. But they didn't ever have any big issues that I know of. It was just like kind of a communication thing that sometimes you could see it was a little bumpy, you know, with translators and whatnot.
Were there also Chinese stunt actors working on the film? Or was it entirely
Definitely.
Your
there,
crew?
There was a whole Chinese stunt team. Like there was probably 15, 20 stunt people because there was a lot of action in this movie.
Yeah.
So we had, you know, Wu Jing had like, because there was like, you know, we had different units going, and that was something that they weren't really used to or hadn't really thought about, was doing running a second unit, like an action unit, simultaneously with the main unit. Because we originally, like for that car chase, Wu Jing, they were like, yeah, we'll do, you know, you guys, we'll be with you for the whole time for the car chase, and I'll get in there when I need to. And I was like, you know, it's going to take us like 10, 12 days to shoot this car chase, and I probably only need you for two of those days to plug you in for some of these close-ups. That's, you know, 10 days of shooting time. You could be shooting other scenes, other dramatic scenes, and we could just get on, you know, on schedule or ahead of schedule. And he was like, oh, like that's a good idea. So they run on, like Chinese productions run on a long time just because it's just their way of doing things. They like to be, and I can't fault them. Like, I would love to be involved in every single frame of my movie too, but there's like certain efficiency that Hollywood has come up with as far as, you know, you got your main unit and your action unit, so you can be out when you don't necessarily need the actors. You just go out with the stunt people and get some, you know, great action pieces, and then bring the actor in and plug them in the necessary close-ups or whatever action you want them in. So we implemented that strategy. But the Chinese stunt team was great. There's Jack Wong was the Chinese stunt coordinator, and he's been on all kinds of famous Hong Kong movies. And he and his team were great. So we had a great collaborative effort between the American and Canadian team, as well as the Chinese team.
Did you guys have like translators on set? Because the composer was telling us that he was having some sort of communication issues in terms of direction.
Yeah, we did. And it was tough because everything took, you know, four times as long, right? Because
yeah.
I say something to the interpreter. And it's an interpreter because it's spoken word. Like, there's no direct translation for some phrases. So I say it to the interpreter, and the interpreter says it to Wu Jing, and then Wu Jing says it back, answers back to the interpreter. Interpreter says it to me. So it's like four, you know, rounds there. It's funny. Wu Jing and I got to a place where we could communicate. His English got better. I learned a few Chinese phrases that I've forgotten since. But then we would almost communicate through look. We wouldn't even have to talk sometimes because the language of action, like we kind of knew language of cinema and action was kind of universal. And we knew what the other one was thinking. We just smile and be like nod our heads. And we'd kind of have an unspoken communication, which was really cool to see develop over the course of the film.
All right, so I think that just about brings us to the end of this episode and this season of Up Roar in the Studio. Thanks again to Carl Xia, Joseph Japanese, Sam Hargrave, and all of our guests on this season.
Our original music comes from Elliot Saltmarsh and Yehuda of Fist with a PH, and our art comes courtesy of Jay Castro.
Follow us on Twitter at China Film Pod, like the Up Roar in the Studio Facebook page, and maybe even Venmo us at Reza-Said with Up Roar in your description. All proceeds go towards training our very moderate rebels. Help out. And if you feel like it, have some thoughts or suggestions, email us at uproarinthestudio, all in one word, at gmail.com.
Though we're taking a break for a couple months, we'll be back soon with a series on Jackie Chan's career post Rush Hour 3. But before we leave you this week, we just want to share some wisdom from the chairman.
To read too many books is harmful. We will see you soon.